I'd like to begin this part one of the two-part episode on the Emperor Franz Josef by reading a segment from Joseph Redlich's biography of the Emperor. Redlich was a historian and politician during the dying days of Austria-Hungary. It has been said of the Habsburgs that many of them had the traits of the genuine artist in their makeup, insofar as they had the powerful impulse to mould the inchoate in accordance with their will. The mystic inheritance of his ancestral house does not fit readily with the dry matter-of-factness of Franz Josef, and yet, in the rigid calm, the almost somnambulistic appearance, somnambulism referring to the sleepwalker, action in sleep, and this very much lends itself to the interpretation of the Emperor's later reign, more as the twilight of the House of Habsburg. The somnambulistic appearance with which the young man of 20 conceived of the idea of a modern, technically efficient autocracy as the only possible reply of revolution in almost every part of his inherited realm, and carried it through simply and solely by the force of his own resolution. In this, there is something analogous to the relation of the artist to the material through which he seeks to convey his thoughts and visions to the outside world, the material, of course, being the anachronistic, composite, highly diverse, and increasingly unstable remnant of the Habsburg monarchy. There was an illicit quality to the nature of Franz Josef's first regime, especially within Hungary, stemming from the emperor's extraordinary ascension to power during the revolutions of 1848-1849, with all the characteristics of a coup d'etat from elements within the army and the ruling dynasty. The deliberate choice of the reign name, Francis Joseph, Franz Joseph, related to the legacy of his grandfather and Joseph II, who was never crowned King of Hungary, and so suffered from a similar crisis of legitimacy. Franz Josef was to be the father of the Austrian peoples, in plural, the first servant of the state, committed yet to a similar policy, a revolutionary, rationalizing policy of the reforming emperor, Joseph II, for the first 20 years at least, yet sans Joseph's zealous, despotic personality. Here we arrive at the appellation of neo-absolutist, the title for the stream, neo-absolutist with a dozen inverted commas. Whatever neo-absolutism was intended to be, Francis's position could not be translated into an Austrian autocracy, such as that mirroring Tsarism in Russia. What was made possible, with the help of his first Prime Minister, Felix von Schwarzenberg, could not be sustained when Franz Josef began his seven-year period of personal rule. The Josephine aspect of Francis's reign was annihilated with his coronation as King of Hungary in 1867, commencing the period of Ausgleich, or compromise. This sorry state of affairs was eerily reminiscent of Joseph II's infamous statement, "Let my epitaph be, here lies Joseph, who failed in everything he undertook." What came after was a Franciscan, i.e. relating to Francis I, not the order of Catholic monks, focused on the preservation of the dynasty. Franz Josef as a second iteration of good Emperor Franz. This in the context of a state whose identity was in crisis, lacking the harmony, the apolitical culture, the coziness or gemütlichkeit of the Bademeyer-Wormatz period. The triumph over the revolutions of 1848 under Franz Josef proved illusory. The Ausgleich and its aftermath was a royal reckoning for the House of Habsburg. The segment that I'm reading now is taken from Wheatcroft's The Habsburgs and focuses on the upbringing of Franz Josef. Franz Josef was the most visible of all the rulers of the House of Habsburg. Yet despite this profusion of images, the constant chronicling of his daily life, The speculation that accompanied the tragedies of his family in later years, the hundreds of studies, both academic and popular, of his personality and empire, he remains opaque, resistant to inspection or interrogation. Many have made the mistake of regarding him as dull or stupid, wooden in his behaviour and unfeeling in his human relationships, but they have to some extent been deceived. Franz Josef guarded his privacy, despite the perpetual gaze of the public. He was perhaps the most complex of the Habsburgs since Maximilian I, a man who was forced to come to terms with a world in which power was slipping from the fingers of those who had formerly ruled by right of birth. He did not fail, although many have questioned the nature and style of his success. Maximilian I became emperor at the beginning of the Protestant Reformation in Germany. He attempted to initiate a series of reforms within Germany, the Reichsreform, but you can really say that Maximilian I is transitional, not just from the medieval era to the early modern period, but also in the sense of the Habsburgs having to be forced out of their German possessions and becoming more associated with their Central European possessions, and ultimately that would manifest into Bohemia, Hungary, Croatia, and Austria itself. From infancy, Franz Josef was brought up with the expectation that he would rule the empire. He was the grandson of the reigning Emperor Franz when he was born, and the nephew of the Emperor Ferdinand. He enjoyed a loving and affectionate childhood, surrounded by adults who were entranced by his sheer vitality, glowing pink skin and shock of fine blonde hair. His uncle, the Duke de Reichstadt, called him a strawberry ice cream topped with whipped cream. His doting grandfather gave the little boy a carriage drawn by 6 horses, and everywhere the Imperial Guard gave him a royal salute. He took the little boy for walks in the palace grounds. Peter Fendi, the artist, shows Francis holding him up to put a banknote in the ammunition pouch of a sentry. The Emperor had given him the tiny sabre he is wearing in the picture. He sat him on his knee and taught him to say his first words of Italian, perhaps remembering his own idyllic childhood in Florence. Toy soldiers were Franz Josef's passion, and he was given his first uniform as a little hussar for his 5th birthday. Of all the influences in his life after his mother, the Archduchess Sophie, his grandfather was probably the most powerful, though he died in Franz Josef's 6th year. One of the little boy's most vivid early memories had been of his grandfather lying dead and having to control his emotions when he wanted to burst into tears. Francis continued to dominate his grandson's life from beyond the grave. When the boy was older, the education scheme devised for him by his mother depended strongly on the instructions which Francis had given for the upbringing of his own children. These bear the mark of the terrible 2 years that Francis himself had experienced at the court of his uncle Joseph II, especially when the emperor virtually placed him in solitary confinement. In his instructions, his grandfather, the Emperor Francis, was explicit. No young archduke was to be left alone, but was to be under constant supervision and guidance at all times. Tutors and teachers were to confer daily, and the program was designed to equip the young of the House of Habsburg with the required physical and professional skills. Physical and professional, rather than intellectual skills, were Francis's preference, revealing his deep and perpetual prejudice against the overstimulated brain. This in the context of Francis' early reign coinciding with the worst impulses of the French Revolution and the execution of his aunt Marie Antoinette. Again, the example of his uncle Joseph was evident, and he emphasized Joseph II's capacity for hard work and his dedication to duty, rather than his passion for reform and change. Later critics have commented adversely on the nature of the young Archduke's education. Alan Palmer, in his study of Franz Josef, said, "As an educational program, the scheme had grave defects, even by the standards of the time. There was too much rote to learning, too little emphasis on how to think, apart from his brothers, virtually no contact with the other children in the classroom. Despite half a century of social upheaval, there was little difference between what Franz Josef was learning in the late 1830s and what his grandfather had been learning 60 years before, except for the increased attention to the minor languages of the empire. In fact, there were many differences from the enlightened education that Francis had received under Leopold's program and had been prescribed for Franz Josef, and it was precisely because of the half century of social upheaval that it was so more constrained and rigorous. The educational scheme was designed to allow no time for idle thought, for straying from the defined path. Palmer goes on to compare the education received by Albert of Saxe-Coburg and the plan devised for the children of Albert and Queen Victoria. Precisely how successful this extraordinary system of indoctrination was for his eldest son, the Prince of Wales, is open to doubt. Franz Josef's training, which is a better term, was over-elaborate, but it was related to the realities of life for a future ruler. It was more important that he should ride well than that he should enjoy the poems of Goethe or even the history of Hormeyer. In fact, both featured, although Franz Josef's favourite pastime was drawing and sketching, for which he displayed talent. The influence of Francis was again apparent, first in the stress on military experience. His own days with the regiment had been the happiest time in Vienna, and then in the imperative need for linguistic mastery. That Francis had been able to talk in Hungarian to his Hungarian subjects had eased his path, and his grandson displayed the same aptitude. Franz Josef, in addition to receiving his political education each week from Prince Metternich, the grey eminence of the House of Habsburg for nearly 40 years, was also taught by Archbishop Rauscher of Vienna, an apostle of the revived force of Catholicism after the rationalist attacks of the 18th century, the rationalist attacks which to some extent were also led by Joseph II. The words which were being poured into his ears from every side were legitimacy, duty, and the need for faith. He dutifully absorbed them all. It was years later that rightly said that he had all the qualities of an ideal regimental officer, limited in his outlook, utterly loyal, and as it turned out, fearless in battle. His education was designed to create a product, as Jean Bled he observed. However we judge Franz Josef's education, it had the merit of coherence. Although it was broadly based, his tutor's concern was always to inculcate an aversion to liberalism in the prince, and to prepare him for authoritarian methods of government, which is not out of place in the context of monarchy in the 19th century. This aspect of his education left an indelible mark on him. The product was right for the times, since no one could imagine the end of the established order. Some parts of the Habsburg lands were experiencing a surge of prosperity and industrial development. The contented, fleshy burghers, the middle classes, male and female, who populated the paintings of the Bademeyer era, were taken from life. The upheavals of the 1830s in France and Belgium, the revolution that deposed Charles X, had left the Austrian lands virtually untouched. There was no seething discontent, just a little political dyspepsia. Franz Josef was educated and trained to rule in the fullness of time during a continuation of these, the good old days. Nevertheless, Francis's reign was not simply a continuation of the good old days, as Wheatcroft describes, but a six-decade-long Indian summer of an empire that would devolve into Christian Europe's greatest anachronism. This notwithstanding moments of profound existential crisis, such as that which thrust the 18-year-old Franz into power, off the back of a conspiracy that dethroned the incapable Emperor Ferdinand on the 2nd of December 1848. The revolutions of 1848 that saw attacks against the Habsburgs on several fronts, from Germany and, crucially, from Hungary. Back to Wheatcroft. An elaborate mythology was erected around the events of the 2nd of December. It could not be called a coronation, so it was normally described as a simple enthronement. But there was no throne, nor any of the traditional regalia, although many of the popular engravings asserted crowns, orbs, and the like to give the event some degree of authenticity. It was, in truth, a coup d'etat, and the Hungarians in particular were quick to recognize its illicit nature. For almost 20 years, until Franz Josef made his pact with Hungary in 1867, the Auskalai, and was crowned in Budapest, dissident Hungarians continued to recognize only their crowned king, the old Uncle Ferdinand, in his retirement in Prague. In 1848, the family had swept away legal niceties to achieve the result that they wanted. This is a segment taken from Martin Brady's The Habsburgs. On the 6th of October, 1849, so nearly a year into the Emperor's reign, the former Prime Minister of Hungary, Count Louis Batthyány, who was also, by the way, the first quote-unquote prime minister of Hungary, seeking its independence under Ferdinand, and he led a delegation asserting the ancient rights of Hungary against the emperor. Louis Batthyány was taken into the courtyard of the main jail of Budapest. An Austrian military court had condemned him to hang for treason on account of his role in promoting Hungary's independence. But he had slit his throat several days earlier in an unsuccessful attempt at suicide. So the court changed the penalty to death by firing squad. Batthyány was so weak that he had to be carried to the place of execution, and there he died, slumped on a chair. Several hours before, at 5:30 a.m., 13 generals in what had been the army of an independent Hungary were also executed in Arad Castle on the same grounds of treason, the majority by hanging. The noose was a harsh punishment, for death came not from the sudden breaking of the neck, but from slow suffocation. It was intended to be humiliating too, for the victim writhed in agony. At the expiry, his bowels usually opened. The executions of Batthyány and the generals came at an end of a bloody war which between Hungary and the Habsburgs that had begun with Jellicik's invasion. Jellicik was a prominent Austrian general alongside his companion Windischgrätz. The country, Hungary, had held out for almost a year. Its resources and the Hungarian population had been mobilized by Lajos Kossuth, the most famous of the Hungarian revolutionaries, and commanded. Even so, it was only in April of 1849 that the Hungarian government proclaimed the country's formal independence from the Habsburgs, deposing the perjured house and appointing Lajos Kossuth governor and regent, effectively the monarch of Hungary in all but name. Until then, Hungary's politicians had held by the conviction that they were acting lawfully in accordance with the terms of the April laws as granted by Emperor Ferdinand, which had been many such contrivances in the later period of Metternich as a result of the liberal triumvirate between Kolovrat and Metternich to keep the Hungarians on side. Finally, in June of 1849, a Russian army invaded Hungary at the request of the new emperor, Franz Josef. With the Austrian general von Haynau pressing from the west and General Paskevich's Russians from the north, resistance collapsed. Kossuth, meanwhile, escaped into the Ottoman Empire. For the remainder of his long life, he died in 1894, Kossuth inveighed against the Habsburgs' rule in Hungary, electrifying audiences in Britain and then the United States. His claim that he had learned English from reading Shakespeare in prison may not be true, but the story enhanced his reputation and the cause of a free and independent Hungary. Visiting England in 1851, Kossuth received a rapturous welcome, feted by tens of thousands in every city in which he spoke. The killing of Batthyány and the generals was the work of Franz Josef, who rejected his minister's proposal of a comprehensive amnesty. But the emperor was not finished with the scaffold and the bloodbath, as one former prime minister put it, and he gave Haynau free rein in Hungary. Hundreds of executions followed, and several thousand longer sentences. Even when the Austrian prime minister, Prince Felix von Schwarzenberg, ordered Haynau to desist from the executions, he carried on until finally being dismissed in July of 1850. Haynau was sufficiently insensitive to buy on a retirement estate in Hungary. He never understood why his neighbours did not invite him to dinner. Emergency rule continued in Hungary until 1854, and some offences remained under the jurisdiction of military courts for several years longer. On top of this, Hungary's counties were abolished and replaced by administrative districts headed by appointees of the Interior Ministry in Vienna, Croatia, Transylvania, and the Banat, together with the neighbouring Vojvodina, were additionally separated from Vienna as crown lands. These were all considered part of the ancient patrimony of St. Stephen, something which would recur again and again in the Hungarians' demand for determination over these territories, which would inform the creation of the Compromise in 1867. All institutions of self-government were abolished, and Germany was made the language, German was made the language of the administration, a la Joseph II. Tasks previously performed by the counties and noble landlords were now undertaken by bureaucrats, many of whom were recruited from elsewhere in the Austrian Empire. The breakup of Hungary into districts ruled from Vienna was part of a plan hatched by Schwarzenberg. as early as December of 1848, the first month of Franz Josef's reign. Developments elsewhere were more haphazard. As one of his first acts, Franz Josef had closed the imperial parliament that had been meeting in Kromovich. In the early hours of 7th of March 1849, troops with bayonets had entered the castle where the parliament met and blocked the entrances, after which they had scoured the city, arresting several of the more radical deputies. In place of constitutional proposals the parliament had devised, Franz Josef imposed a constitution of his own, which, as he explained, was more suited to the times and less influenced by remote and even revolutionary ideas. The decreed or March constitution was in some respects a good one. It was centralist, in the sense that it envisaged one elected parliament for the whole of the Austrian Empire, including Hungary, a single central government and one coronation. The empire up until now had lacked a coronation. Although the emperor retained strong powers, there were layers of various bodies with representation, which possessed a devolved authority. The constitution additionally confirmed the abolition of serfdom previously agreed by the imperial parliament, and this is one of the quote-unquote great achievements of the 1848-9 revolutions, despite the fact that in all other respects they were effectively quashed. For all its merits, the constitution was a ploy. Franz Josef was out to make his mark, and he was lured by Schwarzenberg's dream of joining the entire Austrian Empire to the German Confederation to create a massive new territorial bloc in Central Europe in which the Habsburg Emperor would be politically dominant. In regards to this, it's been hotly debated by Paul Schroeder in particular as to whether, again, you can say this is part of post hoc revisionism to see Felix von Schwarzenberg as an Austrian equivalent of an Otto von Bismarck. But to take, say, for example, Paul Schroeder's line of reasoning, Schwarzenberg's arguments can very much be seen as attempting to restore Austria's position to the presidency of the Confederation, i.e. the status quo before the State of the Revolutions in 1848, and to limit Prussia and her influence and her attempts to snatch away the German presidency or even the German crown. The German crown had been offered to Frederick Wilhelm by the Revolutionary Parliament. To win over the German princes to a scheme, Franz Josef needed to appear as a constitutionalist who was ready to be bound by legal constraints. This in the context of seeing that the Confederation would be a league of the princes and not a despotism. But by the middle of 1851, it was clear that German rulers would not agree to a merger with the Austrian Empire, preferring to renew the Confederation set up after the defeat of Napoleon in 1814. This is also in the context of trying to force the entire Austrian Empire to be part of the German Confederation, as opposed to the lands of Bohemia, Austria, Carniola, etc. So only a part of the Austrian Empire had been considered part of the German Confederation, and seeing all of Austria as part of the German Confederation would perhaps massively inflate the power and prestige of Austria within the context of united Germany. That was certainly a scheme that Schwarzenberg attempted and ultimately failed to achieve. By this time, too, Franz Josef was casting envious eyes on Napoleon III of France, Louis Napoleon, who would later effect his coup as the successor of the original Napoleon, who had, as emperor, admiringly described, seized the reins of power in his hands and made himself more than a machine for writing his signature. Implementation of this constitution went at a snail's pace, and its provisions on local elective governments were drastically pared back. Finally, on New Year's Eve of 1851, Franz Josef issued a series of instructions known collectively as the Sylvester Patent that abolished this constitution and gave himself the right to make laws. The coup was completed after the death of Schwarzenberg in April of 1852, when Franz Josef declared that he would now act in the capacity of Prime Minister. If we can see a moment of neo-absolutism, of recovering these powers and trying to rule in the manner of an Ancien Régime ruler. In fact, this is something very eerily similar of what Louis XV of France did after the death of Cardinal Fleury and the ending of the regency to make himself his own prime minister. In this sense, you can say Francis Joseph is very much beginning his period of personal rule with this Revolutionary Act, offering token concessions and then repealing them once his own position had consolidated. And in this case, as we see with the original creation of the Austrian Empire, was to mimic Napoleon's coronation, Francis creating himself as the double emperor between 1804 and 1806 until the Holy Roman Empire was abolished. This attempt at self-power, the seizure of power from the reins of quote-unquote constitutionalism, very much followed in the mould of aping off of France. The Sylvester Patent introduced a decade of neo-absolutism, or Caesarianism, where Franz Josef ruled as a near-dictator, pushed back against Rady's reference to essentially what a dictator means, because there are so many ways you can infer that. Both terms are recent ones, and at the time, the type of government practiced by Franz Josef was known simply as absolutism, or more tellingly, perhaps bureaucratic absolutism in a more proper Austrian outfit, you can say, for the emperor imposed his will through the administrative apparatus. But the bureaucrats also had their own political agenda, which was to maintain the reforming program of Joseph II, with its belief in the wisdom of state management and the social and economic progress directed from above. They even had a name for themselves, the Party of Enlightenment, not Enlightenment in the sense they were following after the Jacobins or Voltaire in the French Revolution, but fulfilling a much older and tried and true process of Austrian management relating back to the reign of Mary Theresa and Joseph II, an idea known as Cameralissimus, Cameralism, the science of government. Although the Habsburg civil service numbered in the 1850s around 50,000 persons, this included junior and ancillary staff. About 10,000 belonged to the higher policy service, the Konservierdienst, and almost all of these had received a university education, mostly in law. Those in the higher branches were overwhelmingly liberal in disposition and outlook, and disproportionately represented in the reading clubs and during 1848 in the politics of reform. This is to be expected if you look at certain figures like even the Archduke John of Austria and figures such as Kolowrat, who professed ultimately to be a liberal. They were liberals in the sense of believing in individual empowerment through education, legal equality, freedom of the press and of association, and removal of certain economic constraints, i.e. free trade liberals, say for example in the manner that one can perceive them in England. They saw a strong state as the vehicle for a liberal programme of reform and were prepared to make concessions. Press freedom was an early casualty, but by endorsing state intervention, the bureaucrats fattened the state up, turning it into a leviathan that devoured individual freedoms and their liberalism that they had originally championed. The achievements of this bureaucratic absolutism, neo-absolutism, were massive. As one historian had put it, it was a Josephinist fantasy, Joseph II, come true. There were new institutions of science, regulations on safety in mines and the workplace, penny stamp postal service, new roads, telegraphs and railways. By 1854, 1,000 kilometres of track had been laid between Linz and Budweis, a line that was originally built in 1832 and converted from horse to steam power. For the roads, almost 10 million cubic metres of stone were laid in just 3 years. Experts, recruited from London Board of Works, helped to dredge and canalise the Danube and Tisa rivers. Infrastructural expansion was underpinned by a burgeoning coal and iron production, by a developing banking sector for commercial loans, and by the removal of customs barriers that had made the Austrian Empire for the first time into a common market. Vienna, too, was transformed, with the old city walls torn down by a spacious ring built in place of new houses, a new class of entrepreneurs and industrialists created by economic modernization. The peasantry had been freed by Josef II, in the sense they were able to leave their land and marry without their lord's consent. But the land they farmed still belonged to the lord, on which account they owed him dues and services performed by hand. In the early months of the revolution of 1848, the Hungarian Diet, the parliament, had committed itself to giving peasants the lands they farmed. But elsewhere, promises were vague and piecemeal, with the terms of emancipation deferred until the imperial parliament met. The difficulties were that the lords, the magnates, needed some form of compensation for their loss, and that the land that the peasants farmed was of varying quality. Some was ancestral peasant property, farmed over generations, and other was land leased under contract, or else common land that had cleared the peasant personally from a scrub. The imperial parliament had shirked its obligations to facilitate a general emancipation. However, after 1849, the government made a real attempt to resolve the issues arising from this. Ancestral land became peasants in its entirety, with no compensation paid to the landlords. All the rest was compensated for, with the state bearing the brunt of the burden, which it did through the expedient of printing bonds and distributing them slowly. The terms of compensation were worked out by commissions. The new landowning peasants were obliged to enter the details of their properties in land registers. These also recorded liens, whether the property was now leased out or mortgaged, and neighbours, kinsmen, and lenders frequently challenged the content of their registers. The courts in Hungary alone were, in the second half of the century, handling seldom fewer than 300,000 cases a year of disputed entries, with a backlog extending to over a million. In the past, minor disputes such as these would have gone first to the instance of the manor courts or seigneurial courts, but with the abolition of landlordism, one had to go to a landowner's court and the gratis contribution to the administration of the countryside. The state now had to fill the gaps, establishing across the empire 1,500 new courts and supervisory offices. Bureaucrats were dispatched to the countryside to see the implementation of directives from the centre. Their task was a hard one. The interior minister, Alexander von Bach, ordered civil servants in Hungary to buy an uncomfortable uniform based on Hungarian cavalrymen's, but it cost half a year's salary and earned them the ridicule as von Bach's hussars. Under-resourced and living in shabby conditions, they found it impossible to reconcile their obligations with day-to-day realities of the countryside. Arriving in one Hungarian village, a Bach czar found that there would be no prisons. Convicts were instead lodged unguarded in an inn and given a daily allowance for food. Bach's instructions for the civil service stressed the importance of stability, routine, and predictability of outcome in the administrative process. To that end, the Austrian civil law was extended in the 1850s across the entire empire, replacing in Hungary and Transylvania the arcane and largely unwritten customary law. But to meet the local circumstances, the law had to be modified and adapted, thus robbing it of its regulation and uniformity, its homogeneity, so to speak. On top of this, the medley of official circulars, formulary books, clarifications, edicts, and modifications emanating from the centre rendered the law even less certain and its application in individual circumstances unpredictable. Bewildered, bureaucrats frequently referred up so that even trivial matters ended up on the interior minister's desk, von Bach's desk, never to be resolved. In terms of understanding this more than simply the expansion of neo-absolutism as representing bureaucratic absolutism, the Hungarian petty nobility, the magnates, had dominated the political life and the economic life of Hungary since the early medieval times. And so even though it was the Hungarian diet, the revolutionary diet under Lajos Kossuth, who had initiated the emancipation, one has to bear in mind that when Joseph II began it some decades before, it was seen as an attack on the rights of Hungarian noblemen. So the irony is here, the Austrians are taking the impetus from the revolutionary elements, the liberal elements within the Hungarian Revolution, and they are instead here turning them on the Hungarians, the Hungarian nobles themselves, empowering the elements from Transylvania, Nitra, Slovakia, Croatia, the Slovenian Vojvodina. All of this means that the peasant effectively can act as an agent of the emperor, of this centralizing mission of the empire, someone who can appeal to the bureaucrat, over to the manor, over to the landlord, creating a new strata from which to essentially undermine the privileges, and you can even say a conception of a Hungarian ruling elite. And ultimately, as we see with the fundamental inefficiencies underpinning this entire system, it was always in a very precarious state. But there was uncertainty at the top too. Franz Josef was unaccountable, unconstrained by either institutions or a constitution, and this is very much in the way that his grandfather, the Emperor Francis, had conceived of it. In establishing a dynasty, or rather an empire that was purely dynastic, the idea of not being bound by a constitution or any sort of legal precedent or whatever was the same logic that actually forced the emperor to believe that appointing his incapable son, Ferdinand, as emperor would be preferable to allowing some sort of legal oversight over determining who the heir was. Of course, that went brilliantly and had to result in some extra legal coup, effectively, to depose Ferdinand, to elevate Franz Josef into power. But now he is in power, he's going to restore things to the ideal state as it had been envisaged under his grandfather Francis. And that is effectively to have an emperor unmoored, unburdened by requisite authorities or institutions. But the way Rady is referring to this, essentially, is a sense of unaccountability. That's rather unfavorable, but nevertheless, let's continue. Franz Josef was inept, and again, I think, based on everything we can learn about this, we can't necessarily see the emperor as inept. but we can definitely say that his political imagination in certain elements was deficient. Deficient in the sense that if the emperor is going to embark on a period of personal rule after death of Schwarzenberg from 1852 onwards, it essentially requires a man of extraordinary political skill, you can even say genius, to rival, say, for example, that of a Napoleon or that of a Bismarck later on, even though Bismarck wasn't an emperor. And for all of Franz Josef's military training, that extensive education, his proficiency in languages, he wasn't a Joseph II. He lacked the imagination, and in some senses also he lacked the capability in order to effect a wholesale transformation of the empire, whereby he could be that artist taking the putty of the Austrian Empire and moulding it to his vision, a technocratic vision of bureaucratic absolutism. He was inept, I again say deficient, but convinced in his own superior wisdom, like a Caesar. In an example that shocked the British ambassador, he insisted in early 1852 that a cavalry parade take place on the cobblestones before the Schönbrunn Palace in a deep frost, even though there was significant danger. The horses toppled, killing two cuirassiers, and Franz Josef's handling of foreign policy was equally calamitous. He did not support Tsar Nicholas in the Crimean War, thus letting down the ally who had come to his rescue in 1849 to defeat the Hungarian Revolution. But neither did he back the British and the French against Russia. Diplomatically isolated, he was now prey for Napoleon III of France, whose army swept through Lombardy in Austrian possession in 1859, assigning the province to the Kingdom of Piedmont in exchange for France taking Nice and Savoy. It did not help that halfway through the campaign, Franz Josef appointed himself as commander. His generalship led directly to the bloodbath of the Battle of Solferino. 2 years later, having overrun the Habsburg duchies of Parma, Modena, and Tuscany, the Kingdom of Piedmont was proclaimed the Kingdom of Italy. In terms of being able to expand upon this, the concurrent campaign alongside that of Hungary, which Rady has mentioned, was that of the real Radetzky March, led by General Radetzky, a octogenarian who comes in and defeats the forces of King Albert and defeats the first Risorgimento attempt. An attempt by the Kingdom of Piedmont to create a Kingdom of Italy under the House of Savoy. In the second attempt, it was very much supported by the Emperor Napoleon III, without which one can't really conceive of a united, independent Italy, as would ultimately transpire historically. But nevertheless, to look at Solferino as a unnecessary, or him directly contributing to a bloodbath, Solferino wasn't that decisive in terms of a French defeat. The French won, but also Napoleon himself was so traumatized by the battle that he essentially resolved to never fight a similar battle directly. And so you can say both Napoleon III and Franz Josef were overestimating their abilities and deciding that the battle should be fought over, led by two respective emperors. So, in the first instance, Radetzky had saved Austria's possessions in Lombardy and Venetia, and in the second instance, in 1859, 10 years later, Franz Josef had failed to achieve a similar result. As it pertains to his involvement in the Crimean War, that will actually be the subject of an entire stream on this channel because it's the failure there, the ultimate failure, I would say, of the personal rule of Franz Josef, which is going to inform everything going forward, right up until the declaration of war on Serbia during the crisis of 1914. All of this, I believe, comes back to that fatal diplomatic blunder at the beginning of his personal rule in 1852, 1853. So bear that in mind. In April of 1859, the Austrian National Bank collapsed, refusing to honor its own currency. Franz Josef had treated the bank as a grand state treasury, taking what he needed, and he simply did not understand what it meant when earlier that year his agents had been refused a loan under the London market. The bankers would not lend to an unaccountable monarch, unaccountable in the sense that, again, he was unmoored by various legal constraints, and so his actions were very unpredictable. As Anselm Rothschild put it bluntly, no constitution, no money. And you can also say there's an obvious hint of political subversion and intrigue going on there. Not to say simply as a result of Franz Josef's own constitution, but rather a desire to undo the experiment of neo-absolutism. The absolutist experiment had not lived up to expectations and had failed to harness the energies of the Austrian Empire. He wrote, Centralization, this is the finance minister Karl Ludwig von Bruck. Centralization should be cooled down and a sound, enduring constitution imposed, but no one that revived the antique arrangement of the past. So you can sort of read sort of many elements in that, but you also have to understand that, as with so many regimes, including the regime of Napoleon III, as with political reforms at home, all of these things can be suspended and upended by de military defeats abroad, as we saw in France, and indeed, as we see with the diplomatic calamity against Russia in the Crimean War. Typically, Franz Josef did exactly what Bruck advised him not to do, casually commenting to his mother that we will now have a little parliament. He resuscitated an older institution, the Imperial Council or Reichsrat, packing it with aristocratic devotees in the hope that it would be mistaken for a parliament. To further the deception, he called recalled diets so that they may send representatives to join the Imperial Council, but only ones that he approved. In his October diploma of 1860, a diploma is a solemn decree stronger than that of a patent, such as the Sylvester patent, Franz Josef declared thus Pinocchio's nose of a constitution to be permanent and irrevocable, but the bankers still refused to lend. Ignaz von Plehner, who had replaced Bruck as finance minister, was adamant in his advice to Franz Josef. Financial stability could only be assured, he explained, when the National Bank was freed from government interference and when borrowing was subject to oversight by genuinely representative institutions. Again, what these institutions have in terms of separating and establishing the independence of the National Bank, again, it's somewhat a leap in logic. But again, in terms of looking at this as deception, all of this is to portray, I would say, a fundamentally hostile approach to what Franz Josef was doing. As mentioned by Wycroft, Franz Josef was brought up under the aegis of the good old days of his grandfather, good Emperor Francis. Francis had only allowed constitutional contrivances insofar as he could not be mawed by any of them. He didn't have a constituency which was arriving out of any sort of sense of legality other than the perpetuation of his own dynastic authority. To be a Habsburg was enough, to be head of the House of Habsburg was to be enough to rule over the House of Austria's empire, the Empire of Austria, as he so determined. So when looking at institutions like the Reichsrat, we have to also bear in mind that this institution was played around with someone like Metternich. Metternich had even hoped to use the Reichsrat in a similar way of using it as a body for which to circumvent the influence of people in the Habsburg family who were hostile to him after the death of his benefactor, Francis II, and he had to be forced into this humiliating position of sharing power with his arch rival Colowrat during the reign of Ferdinand I. This, a period in which Metternich really hoped to be able to dominate the empire and not be controlled by any intervening factors. Instead, that went terribly. So you can say that Franz Josef really is picking up a formula with which he had inherited, and he's trying to act in accordance with that formula. Because indeed, the whole notion of turning the empire on its head and making it into a constitutional parliamentary body in a sincere sense, say, for example, like that of Great Britain, or France before the revolution, say for example during the reign of Louis-Philippe, is a dangerous experiment, which had the ability of not only undermining the authority of the emperor, but as we saw during the revolutions of 1848, 1849, perhaps leading to the wholesale dissolution, disintegration of the empire. So to call it simply an act of deception is very unfair. If Franz Josef is concerned with one thing again, in the legacy of Joseph II and the legacy of Francis, it is the preservation and perpetuation of the House of Habsburg, something that's going to inform all of his decisions up until his death in 1916. Franz Josef ultimately had to give way, setting aside the permanent and irrevocable October diploma with the so-called February patent of 1861. Technically, explanatory of the October diploma, this patent gave the Austrian Empire a parliament, even though it retained the old name and image of an imperial council. It was made up of two houses, an upper house of high aristocrats and churchmen, and a lower house comprising deputies sent by other diets, which consented for all needs of legislation. New regulations, published at the same time, laid down qualifications for voting to the diets, extending the franchise to about a quarter of the adult male population, and introducing a complicated procedure for casting ballots that advantaged the German-speaking population, indeed continuing in this vein of Joseph II's original reforms. The February patent kept many of the Emperor's powers, including policy over the army and foreign policy. Most importantly, the emperor chose the government and ministers responsible to him, and this, of course, indicative of nearly every system in Germany. Invariably, Franz Josef appointed bureaucrats and not politicians to his ministries. Again, technocratic, bureaucratic absolutism. Having served in the administration, they were more likely to be personally loyal to the emperor, and in any case, he valued expertise over politics and posturing. A bureaucratic elite, therefore, still made up most of the important political decisions. On top of this, legislation was frequently enacted in the form of administrative decrees that bypassed the parliamentary process entirely. Bureaucratic absolutism thus gave way not to a government by any form of democratic or representative institutions, but instead of a form of bureaucratic constitutionalism. And again, I think that's almost taking it a bit too far. I would say bureaucratic absolutism tempered by elements of constitutionalism. At the head of this apparatus remained the man who described himself as the empire's first civil servant, the emperor. At work by 5 in the morning, Franz Josef busied himself with paperwork, often correcting ministerial drafts or rewriting them entirely. His office routinely was broken by meetings with his ministers and twice a week with general audiences at which any of his subjects might petition him personally. Here, his bureaucratic routines proved their worth, for a filing system meant that he could keep up with every petitioner, whether he had visited before, and if so, what his concerns had been and the remedies given. Franz Josef kept going through the day on Virginia cigarettes and coffee, which he replaced in old age with mild cigars and tea. The knowledge he acquired in matters of state was formidable, but it lay unsorted in his mind with trivial matters of protocol, often of the uttermost. And again, this conception with the idea that the emperor is unmoored in terms of legal institutions, but the idea that he considered himself despotic or unaccountable simply isn't true, in the sense that the right to petition harkens back to the most old, and you can almost say authentic, notion of monarchy, that the monarch has a special connection to the land, to his peoples directly, and so any one of his people has the right to direct partition, as the emperor, as the supreme arbiter of justice, is seen above the bureaucrats, and you can say has the ability to countermand them, and that the empire isn't simply a faceless managerial institution, but the emperor is a monarch in fact and not simply a monarch in name. That is a form of accountability that you can say informs this Habsburg dynastic conception of monarchy. Franz Josef treasured the Austrian presidency of the German Confederation, something which had been restored after the 1848 revolutions, for it provided a vehicle for projecting power as far afield as the Baltic and North Sea, as well as suggesting dynastic continuity with the old Holy Roman Empire, and that very much weakened, as I mentioned elsewhere on this channel. As late as 1863, Franz Josef was still hoping to be offered the German imperial crown, but Prussia also had ambitions to leadership in Germany, with the Prussian ambassador to the Confederation, Otto von Bismarck, expressed with typical forcefulness. He himself had done everything in his power to try and upend even the most trivial of privileges which had been afforded to Austria over the other German states in the constitution of the German Confederation, such as the right of the representative to smoke cigars, etc. In 1862, on the eve of his appointment as the Prime Minister of Prussia, Bismarck explained to the conservative politician, later Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, how he planned to reorganize the Prussian army. He then went on, "I shall seize the first best pretext to declare war against Austria, dissolve the German Confederation, subjugate the minor states, and give national unity to Germany under Prussian leadership. I have come here to say this to the Queen's ministers." But Bismarck did not say it to the British government. The Austrian ambassador was also in the room with Disraeli. And this again was one of Bismarck's greatest strategies, to disarm with complete and utter forthrightness. In Franz Josef's case, forewarned was not forearmed. On the flimsiest of pretexts, Prussia declared war on the Austrian Empire, defeating the Habsburg Empire in a lightning campaign waged over 7 weeks in 1866. In terms of contextualizing this, in 1863, 1864, there is a war over Schleswig-Holstein in Denmark. Austria and Prussia are allied with this. Franz Josef allies with Prussia. And as a result of that war, the territory, formerly the duchies of Denmark held in personal union, were partitioned, And it was actually the fractious, unsustainable nature of this partition and Austria's attempt, you can say, to undermine Prussia's hold over Schleswig by supporting a Holstein, a duke, or whatever, that Bismarck was able to take as a pretext for saying essentially that Austria was undermining that agreement and that the German Confederation should expel Austria, which was also its president. Hence the pretext ultimately that Bismarck was able to contrive by allying with Austria in a previous war, just to add some more context to that. The Kingdom of Italy, Prussia's ally, counted on the winning side. Even though it was defeated at the Battle of Lissa in the Adriatic, in the first fleet battle to involve ironclad warships, Italy was rewarded with Venice. Venice and Lombardy had been, alongside the other duchies in Tuscany, etc., had been the core of Habsburg power. Indeed, you have to remember back to the fact that the dynasty, the new dynasty, essentially after Leopold II, began its rule in Tuscany before it began its rule in Austria. So there is a deep dynastic connection with these territories, all of which have been lost in 1859, with the exception of Venice, which was held on. Venice, which essentially allowed for Austria to maintain its control of the Adriatic, as was demonstrated by the fact the Italian fleet was defeated. But nevertheless, Italy, by simply joining the right side, despite the fact it is not militarily victorious, is able to claw away this vital province of Venice. And as a result, you can say, Austria now clings onto territories such as the Tyrol and Istria and other more spurious conceptions of Italian irredenta, such as Dalmatia, which will become the focal point for later Italian expansion during the First World War. Italy was now rewarded with Venice, while Bismarck rolled up all the states north of the River Main into a new North German Confederation under Prussian presidency. Less than 5 years later, the South German states gave way, joining Bismarck's newly proclaimed German Empire. The Habsburg link to the German lands, which had persevered throughout the history of the dynasty and has survived both Napoleon, that being the dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire in 1806, and the revolutions of 1848, was now finally severed. And this, in a way, you can say symbolically, was one of the greatest defeats for the Habsburg Empire in its history. You know, greater perhaps than when Charles the Fifth, the Holy Roman Emperor, was forced to concede the Peace of Augsburg, or when the Emperor Ferdinand had to concede the Peace of Westphalia, because even in that sense, even though the Emperor was diminished within Germany, he still held the rank of primus inter pares, the first among equals of all the German princes. But now, the House of Hohenzollern has achieved what Frederick II, Frederick the Great, could not achieve against Mary Theresa, or what Charles VII, the Bavarian Emperor, tried to achieve in terms of deposing the Habsburgs. But now the Hohenzollerns have definitively deposed the Habsburgs as the nominal suzerains of all over Germany. And you can say in that sense that Franz Joseph has to endure one of the dynasty's greatest ever defeats. And hence, going back to my original comment, that as we see the long Indian summer of an empire, this in turn becomes the Austro-Hungarian Empire, turns into Christian Europe's greatest anachronism, having lost that prestige within Germany itself. In less than 20 years, Franz Josef had lost Lombardy and Venice in Italy, and had lost presidency of the German Confederation. And it's from these defeats that we see the events leading up to the Ausgleich, the compromise, and the coronation in Hungary, undoing effectively, you can say, the era of military occupation and divide and rule that had been seen in Hungary. But that will be a subject for the second part of this series on Franz Josef.